listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hey, this is Shane Vanderhart. Thanks for listening. I hope you had a great 4th of July. I managed not blowing off any of my digits as we enjoyed our second year of fireworks freedom here in Iowa. My community, Pleasant Hill, did not attempt to implement a local ban of fireworks, which state law actually allows, unlike our neighbors to the west, Des Moines, which, based on my social media feed yesterday, did not work out so well for the city council. A lot of people ignoring Des Moines' ban, apparently. We did not do anything too major, you know, mainly fountain fireworks. If you happen to follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/ Shane Vanderhart, I got some videos of some of our fireworks up there. We do those as opposed to rockets. I just didn't feel comfortable shooting off any of those in my neighborhood. I just have visions of these sparks coming down and lighting people's roofs on fire. If we lived in the country, though, then, you know, obviously rockets, anything else. I also had the strange urge to blow up some watermelons. I don't know if you saw that viral video going around Facebook, but, you know, I successfully resisted. I didn't actually blow anything up. Well, anyway, we have a number of things to talk about today. First of all, there are two studies that say we are a nation of narcissists. Also, the left is freaking out over the Supreme Court. The Episcopal Church debates whether God is male. And then I want to play a conversation I had earlier this week with Erica Anderson, who is the author of a new book that I read over the weekend, Leaving Cloud Nine, The True Story of a Life Resurrected from the Ashes of Poverty, Trauma, and Mental Illness. Before we get to any of that, first a word from our podcast sponsors, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Apparently, as a nation, we are a bunch of narcissists. William Wan at the Washington Post writes, in a study published in the journal Psychological Science, researchers asked more than 2,800 residents how much their home state contributed to the history of the United States. He writes, residents of Delaware, based on the average of their state, helped create 33% of their nation's history. Georgians believe their state played almost a central role with 28%. Texans and Californians ranked themselves at 21% and 22%, which was massive, but nowhere near Virginia's 41% and Massachusetts' 35%, unquote. You know, I'll go on the record to say that Iowa's role in our nation's history is extremely limited. I guess that means I'm not a narcissist. He continues, quote, what was universal was that the self-aggrandizing view people have when it comes to their own states, a kind of communal selective memory and self-importance that psychologists are just beginning to study and have dubbed collective narcissism. Even folks in the state of Kansas and Wyoming, which weren't part of the original 13 colonies or historical powerhouses, had outsized opinions of their role in American history, unquote. They added up each state's response and it came to like 907%. Iowans answered 9%, and we landed at 1% on their narcissist index, which I guess is pretty low, so good for us. The left flips out over the Supreme Court. This is just a continuation. There's been this collective meltdown that has occurred ever since Justice Anthony Kennedy announced that he's going to be retiring. Jeffrey Toobin, who's the chief legal analyst, and I use that title loosely, as CNN wrote a piece in The New Yorker, which would make one believe the sky is falling as a result of Justice Kennedy's retirement. He writes about a future conservative court. Quote, it will overrule Roe v. Wade, allowing states to ban abortions and to criminally prosecute any physicians and nurses who perform them. It will allow shopkeepers, restaurateurs, and hotel owners to refuse service to gay customers on religious grounds. It will guarantee that fewer African Americans and Latino students attend elite universities. It will approve laws designed to hinder voting rights. It will sanction execution by grotesque means. It will invoke the Second Amendment to prohibit states from engaging in gun control, including the regulation of machine guns and bump stocks, unquote. First, I hope Roe v. Wade is overruled. It was a horrible ruling that had no basis in the text of the Constitution, but some asinine reinterpretation of the 14th Amendment's due process clause. It was utter nonsense. I think Justice Blackham, who wrote the decision, was on drugs when he did it. I mean, it was crazy. You know, stare decisis, that principle, stare to decisis, let the ruling stand, let the decision stand. If that's the end all and be all of court opinions for Tubin and other liberals who'd say, hey, you know, who say court precedent, they shouldn't overturn themselves. Well, then, you know, Dred Scott v. Sanford should still have never been overturned, and neither should Plessy v. Ferguson. You know, bad decisions should be overturned. The Supreme Court, they are not infallible. And Roe was poorly decided, and I really do hope it's overturned. And frankly, I think doctors and physicians and nurses who perform abortions should be subject to criminal prosecution. I've been very clear about that. I think that would be a good thing. I think we would see fewer abortions. I think we need to protect life. It's the Declaration of Independence clearly states that the right to life is an inalienable right, and then the 5th and the 14th Amendments say that the life should not be taken without due process. Well, if that is okay for a person facing criminal charges and capital punishment, shouldn't that apply also to unborn babies? I think so. Second, for the legal, as far as a legal analyst, Tubin is pretty dense when it comes to what is going on with Christian bakers and florists and photographers turning down service for same-sex marriages and wedding ceremonies. Jack Phillips, who had his case, he won his case before the Supreme Court in Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. He had gay customers. He just didn't want to make a custom cake for a same-sex wedding, something that would violate his religious conscience. Baronelle Stutzman, whose ruling against her at the Washington State Supreme Court was overruled or vacated and then referred back to the state Supreme Court to reconsider looking at the Supreme Court's ruling in Masterpiece Cake Shop. You know, she was served the very homosexual man for years who complained. Well, actually, he didn't actually file a complaint. It was their attorney general, the state's attorney general, that found out about her denial of you know, providing floral arrangements for his same-sex wedding ceremony via Facebook, and he filed charges and sued her in court. You know, she provided flowers for him all the time, but just could not do his wedding ceremony because it would violate her religious conscience. This holds true across the board for all those who have had any complaints filed against them. They were not opposed to serving and have served those who are LGBTQ. It's just they will not participate in same-sex wedding ceremonies. I don't understand why people don't understand the difference. Anyway, but I think you should have freedom of association. You should be able to deny service to anyone you like. I don't necessarily think it's the best thing to do. I think if you care about the free market and capitalism, it certainly is not a good thing to do. But in the case of not providing service for a same-sex wedding because it violates your religious conscience, I totally agree that with that. But I don't hear Tubin complaining about the pro-life activists who are Christian that were thrown out of a gay-owned coffee shop in Washington and nothing was done about that. I don't hear him complaining about that. I also don't hear him complaining about the, you know, the gay bakers who decided not to provide a custom cake for that was pro traditional marriage. No complaints there. So anyway, it was just that comment was just stupid. His comments about elite universities, frankly, is just racist. Does he believe minority students need affirmative action to get into elite universities? Apparently so. His comment about capital punishment is just a bad faith argument. Conservatives are not in favor of grotesque executions. That's just crazy talk. Then in terms of the Second Amendment, oh, the voting rights too. It's like, oh, I know. Horrible that we ask people to show an ID before they can vote. That's not a poll tax. That's not an exam that people have to take. That's not what was done in the 60s and earlier to try to block, in particular black voters from voting. That's crazy. It's an ID. But in terms of the Second Amendment, I hope they should overturn a lot of gun control regulations. It's a fundamental right, and the court should look at any restriction brought before them with strict scrutiny. I'm doubtful that a conservative court would overturn restrictions on fully automatic weapons, though, and no one's really asking them to do that. Katrina Vanden Heuvel at the Washington Post had a meltdown over the court's Janus v. AFSCME ruling. In that decision, the courts, she writes, quote, in the decision, the court's five conservative justices invoked the First Amendment to prohibit unions representing public employees from collecting an agency fee for the cost of bargaining on behalf of workers who benefit from that bargaining but choose not to join the union. In doing so, they trample the will of the elected state legislatures and about 40 years of precedent. Contrary to the court's claim, the case has nothing to do with individual workers' free speech. Every worker is free to speak and organize as they choose. The court isn't protecting speech. It is protecting free riders, allowing workers to benefit from collective bargaining and representation without paying a fair share for its cost. The ruling doesn't empower workers. It weakens their voice and constricts their ability to organize at the workplace, in communities, and in the public arena. This doesn't protect speech. It just undermines public employee unions, unquote. Now, considering everything public sector unions do is public speech, including collective bargaining, then yes, forced payments to unions does violate the First Amendment. Also, quote, free riders, unquote, did not choose to have these unions bargain for them. Nope, they didn't ask these unions to bargain for them. In many cases, when there was a vote in the collective bargaining unit, they voted against it. You know, that in itself is unconstitutional. They're taking away that individual worker's right to bargain on his or her own behalf. Also, it's not the court's job to empower workers. It's to uphold the Constitution. And frankly, forcing people to pay for political speech they disagree with is a violation of the First Amendment. No, it doesn't necessarily prohibit their own free speech, but it's coercing them to pay for things, speech that works against them, and that's just unreasonable. This Janus ruling also does not constrict the union's ability to organize. It does not undermine public employee unions. It just means they have to be persuasive in order to get people to join. Awful, I know. She continues, quote, progressives need to expose the reality that the right-wing gang of five in the Supreme Court is trampling the will of the people and overturning precedents to serve the interests of plutocrats and the right. These black-robed rulers are legislating from the bench, scorning even an effort to find common ground with their own colleagues. In a time of deep polarization, the lawless majority of the court has chosen to side with the powerful few against the vast majority. That cannot be allowed to stand, unquote. I just find this rich. the court since the 60s has trampled on the will of the people. This ruling overturns a bad precedent which allowed this unconstitutional practice to go unchecked for 40 years. People can still join unions. Non-union members can still pay agency fees if they so choose. They just can't be forced to. Considering the court has mandated abortion on demand and same-sex marriage on the basis of reinterpreting the Constitution and invalidating numerous state laws and state constitutional amendments, I find her contention that the Janus ruling is, quote, legislating from the bench, unquote. It's ludicrous. The Episcopal Church decides whether to make its Book of Common Prayer gender neutral. Julie Zausner with the Washington Post reports, quote, "The leaders of the Episcopal Church, the American denomination that descended from the Church of England, but has long been separate from its British mother church, will consider two dueling resolutions at their triennial convention, which begins Tuesday in Austin and runs through next week." So it actually started a couple days ago. Quote, "One resolution calls for a major overhaul of the Book of Common Prayer, which was last revised in 1979. A wholesale revision would take years, the church says, meaning a new prayer book wouldn't be in use until 2030. Switching to gender-neutral language is the most commonly mentioned reason to make the change, but many stakeholders in the church want other revisions. And there are advocates for adding language about a Christian's duty to conserve the earth, for adding a liturgical ceremony to celebrate a transgender person's adoption of a new name, for adding same-sex marriage ceremonies to the liturgy, since the church has been performing such weddings for years, for updating the calendar of saints to include important figures named as saints since 1979. The competing resolution says that the church should not update the Book of Common Prayer now, and should instead spend the next 3 years intensively studying the existing book, which has its roots in the first Anglican prayer book published under the same title in 1549, unquote. I'll just say this. There's a lot wrong here. In terms of Christian orthodoxy, the Episcopal Church has gone off the rails years ago. And I'd encourage any listener who may attend an Episcopal Church to leave it, like this week, and go find a church that faithfully preaches the Word of God. There's a reason that this denomination is shrinking in size. It's because it's faithless. It's apostate church, and frankly, I don't see how any faithful Christian could remain a part of it. So I'd encourage you to leave quickly, run away from that church. Next, I have a conversation with Erica Anderson, author of Leaving Cloud Nine, The True Story of a Life Resurrected from the Ashes of Poverty, Trauma, and Mental Illness. It's a book about her husband's actually childhood. Anderson is a freelance writer who also serves as the digital marketing director at the Independent Women's Forum. She previously wrote for and was the digital director at National Review. Prior to that, she was a digital manager at the Heritage Foundation and worked in communications for Vice President Mike Pence when he was a congressman at the GOP conference. She lives in Indianapolis, Indiana, with her husband and two children. Before I play the recording of that conversation, first a word from Brian Myers, a senior contributor with Caffeinated Thoughts, about Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America.
Hi, this is Brian Myers. When I needed a better life insurance plan, I found it with Travis Riswold of Modern Woodmen of America. When I first met Travis, he wasn't like some other life insurance agents that can be pushy and try to get you to buy something. Travis just made himself available to me. That was it. He told me to let him know if and when I needed anything, and he stayed in touch. When the day came and I did need to make some changes with my life insurance, Travis met with me and walked me through several options so I could make an informed decision. Ultimately, it was the best decision for my situation. So if you need a life insurance plan that makes sense for you, call my friend Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. His number is 515-883-0029. That's Travis Riswold with Modern Woodmen. He can help you find the life insurance you need. Call him at 515-883-0029.
Hey, Erica, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us on the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. So I had the opportunity to read your book, Leaving Cloud Nine, over the weekend. And, you know, as I read through it, some things, you know, really, well, and it, right off the bat occurred to me. It's like, wow, this is like raw. This is like, you know, very transparent. And I'm thinking, when did you decide I'm going to write a book about my husband's childhood experiences? And then how did he respond to that when you talked to him about, you know, doing this, possibly doing this?
Yeah, well, you know, towards the beginning of a relationship, I started to hear all these stories about his past and his childhood. And it was a life that I had never personally experienced. And I was just learning about what it was like for someone to grow up as an abused and neglected child. And it was heartbreaking to hear the things that he would tell me. Just, you know, stories would just come out here and there. And I said, your life sounds like a book or a movie. I just, you know, I was like, this is crazy. Like, I feel like, you know, this is the kind of thing that you see in a movie or read about in a book. And he just said that he told me you should write it. You should write the book.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so it was really originally kind of came from his idea. And as soon as he said that, really, my brain clicked and I was like, well, I guess I could, you know? And so soon after that, we started doing interviews and we started way back from even, you know, before he was born, just getting some of the history of his family, because that of course plays into how he got there. And started doing interviews and putting the book together, and over took a few years, but eventually finished it.
Okay, so as I read through, I've worked with youth for 20 years, and 13 of those years were high risk youth. So a lot of his story, I worked with kids from similar circumstances. Obviously, each kid's unique and has a different story. But one of the things that occurred to me was just, especially early on in his childhood when he was being bounced around from, you know, different house to motel room, it reminded me of a story that a social worker told me as I was working with system kids, kids in detention, as well as kids who were child need of assistance. That's what we call, you know, kids in the foster care system in Iowa. You know, I was thinking, wow, attachment issues. You know, he gave the example of, you know, attachment issue or attachment disorder is like a kid being shoved out the door. As in the school bus story you shared in the book kind of reminded me of this too, being shoved out the door of the school bus, and you get on the school bus and you get off the school bus, and suddenly, you know, when you come home and you realize your house has moved. And you stay up all night and you look for your house, you finally find it, only to have your parent, you know, your mom or your dad push you back out the school bus, say, it's time for school, you need to go. And the cycle continues to where you finally say, you know what, I've had it. I'm just going to build a house right where I got off the bus. I'm going to put trap doors and false doors in there to keep people out, because I am kind of sick and tired of this, you know, this constant being moved around and not being able to count on people. And, you know, kids I found that have that background, I mean, it is very difficult to build a relationship with them, humanly speaking. What was it like for you and him, you know, when you first got together, that, you know, because relationships, you mentioned the book, did not come easy for him, you know, so what was that like? I mean,
well, you know, it's interesting because he kind of takes this from, he has this pattern that he repeated that was kind of passed down to him and his family. Even his grandmother, I don't think this was actually documented in the book, but even his grandmother was married 3 or 4 times. Wow. Had children from multiple people before she ended up ultimately marrying his grandpa, who they stayed married for a long time. But then his mother has been married, I mean, we don't even know how many times she's been married. We actually just uncovered, since the book has been published, we actually uncovered another marriage that we weren't even aware of.
Wow.
So she's been married, you know, 4 or 5, who knows how many times. So these dysfunctional relationships and what's the word I'm looking for?
Codependency.
Codependent. Yeah. I'm like, I knew it was a co. codependent relationships, that's something that's a generational cycle in his family. And so that's something that he latched onto as well. So although he had very few friendships or, you know, any kind of good relationships like that, he always gravitated towards relationships with women, to kind of like, that was kind of his comfort, because he didn't, that was all he had. He didn't really have, you know, other family once he became an adult. And so when we met, he, you know, pretty soon off the bat, I could tell that he had some major emotional issues stemming from his childhood. And so, he was really good at the one-on-one thing, but his emotional issues on dealing with other people, you know, if we were ever to deal with, you know, to go anywhere where there was other people involved or anything to do with family, you know, family events with my family, things like that, that was when things got extremely difficult because he just didn't know how to deal with healthy people.
Right.
He wasn't used to healthy people. And so that was difficult for him. And then also he just kind of, he did this thing, you know, something that happened is he tried to say like, we should get married right away, like right after we met. And that was really scary for me. And he had already been married twice. And so I thought, oh my gosh, like, whoa, slow down. And so that was like a clear indicator of, you know, something.
We need to work on something.
Here.
Yeah, we need to work.
Yeah, something's off here.
Yeah.
So, and then I would just say, oh, I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Your question. Well, yeah, I was just, you know, you're thinking, hey, slow down. And I suppose at the age how old were you when you met him? You were like middle
20. I was 28.
28. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure if it was early 30s, but I'm sure there was probably at your point too, that you're probably thinking, you know, you're eager to get married eventually, I would assume.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like, oh, that I can understand probably the temptation you felt. It's like, you know, while it's you mentioned you were both scary and excited too.
Yeah, and I think he kind of, I think this is, you know, it was like when we met was when he really started to grow and change in a lot of ways, okay. And I think he really caught himself on that one. Like he saw that he did that, and like I don't think my response was as enthusiastic, maybe. I mean, he didn't ask me to marry him at that point, but it kind of like came up, and
right.
I think he kind of caught himself, and like that was part of his growing process, realizing this is one of my problems. Like I remember him saying to me, "I'm addicted to being in love," like because that was just something he would run to. Like that was an addiction that he had, was relationships and love and women, and he realized that that was not the answer. Like he had already been divorced twice, and like.
Right.
Had we gotten married at that point, he might have been divorced a third time.
Right. Well, yeah.
So,
stats.
I didn't know him well enough.
Yeah. And stats show that the more you're married, as far as times being married, the greater your chance of being divorced. Things that, you know, obviously that stat was probably going in your mind too.
I've thought about that a lot.
I bet. So what are some things that you did you guys have done to help overcome that?
Well, you know, one thing he told me, you know, he just told me that when we met and he, you know, realized, hey, here's a pretty healthy person. This is a good person, a person with a good family, somebody that loves God. I think it was a little scary to him because he hadn't been in a relationship with someone that he considered, I don't know, maybe like the kind of person that he would really want to. And so I think he says it opened his eyes to some of his own faults in his previous relationships. Mm-hmm. Like he said, you know, I realized that the common denominator in the failures in my relationships was me.
Right.
And it kind of opened his eyes to see where some of his faults were. And I don't say that to say like I'm perfect or I didn't have right. problems or I wasn't broken at all. I feel like it comes out that way sometimes, and that's not at all how I mean it, but just in terms of his own journey, he started to recognize some things about himself. And I think that was part of God working in his life too at that time to reveal things to him. And so slowly he started to take on those things and would recognize when he was doing something that was maybe the wrong reaction. And this was also dealing with him having, under this diagnosis of being diagnosed with bipolar disorder and, having recently, fairly recently before that, being discharged from the army for having depression and anxiety. So he was dealing with so many demons at the same time. And then me was recognizing these things and learning that if we were going to stay together, I was going to have to really be a compassionate and understanding person about someone dealing with these problems and help him deal with them as his partner.
So, what advice would you give to spouses that are, in relationships where their husband or their wife or, they are going through bipolar disorder or some other type of mental illness? What can they do to be a better support?
Well, I think the first thing to do is educate yourself, and that's what I did. Is I got a bunch of books. I got a book about being married to someone that has bipolar disorder, and depression. I learned a lot about what it means and what it does to someone's brain and why they react the way that they do. Because if you can understand why someone is doing something, it helps you have a better reaction yourself. Because if you can say, oh, he's doing that because of XYZ, then you don't have to get upset about it. You can say that's the illness taking over, and either we'll talk about this later, or here's the best kind of reaction to give to someone when they're having a flare-up. Because it's not going to be, you can't, it's not like you're talking to a normal person. You can't have a conversation with someone that's in the middle of a flare-up with a mental illness, like as if they're just a normal, healthy person, because that's just not how it's going to work. And so when you kind of learn, here are the strategies to dealing with and living with someone that is dealing with this, then you can have a much better life. And then the other thing is, that person that's dealing with a mental illness, really, I mean, you can't force someone to do something, but they really need to be seeing a therapist and getting the medication that they need to help them. And luckily, my husband was always very open to that. And there were times when he wasn't on the right stuff, or there was a couple times where he stopped taking it. Well, that's not good, and that can really rearrange everything in your life because your brain isn't the way it's supposed to be. And so I think, you need to have a spouse that's willing to do that. If you don't, it's a lot harder if you're dealing with someone that's unwilling to get the help they need.
So, there are unfortunately a lot of kids that grew up in circumstances like Rick's. And I'm afraid with the opioid crisis, we're going to see even more kids like that. How, what advice would you give, or what advice do you think your husband would give to those who have a family member that is struggling with opioid abuse or any kind of substance abuse issue?
Well, it is really hard. I mean, so in this circumstance, so many times I'm thinking of the kids, because so many kids are affected by that. And so my first thought on that question is, if you know someone that's struggling and they have kids, make sure that those kids have access to either you or another loving, caring adult that can be there for them and give them some guidance. Because they're, I mean, if their p parent actually has an addiction, that kids probably shouldn't be in the home. But either way, it's the kids are lacking access to someone who's really able to care for them and give them direction that they need, and they're going through trauma. And so, for Rick growing up, he didn't really have anyone that was there for him. I mean, at one when he was a little bit older as a teenager, there was a boyfriend of his mom's that provided some stability for
That
him.
was James.
Yes. And so that was a good thing, but like that's just about the only person he can point to, and that's really unfortunate because as a I had a teacher write to me yesterday and say, I'm so glad I read your book because I wish I had read it 10 years ago when I was teaching elementary school in like a rural poor community, because I don't think I had the compassion that I needed to have for some of the kids. Not I didn't realize some of these things that they were going through. And it was really sad to me because, many of us can look back at our lives and say, oh, there was a teacher that really stood out to me, that this was my favorite teacher. And like my husband, he can't think of any teacher that ever reached out to him or ever made him feel like they cared. And that just makes me really sad. And that's not a knock on teachers at all.
Right.
It's just a reminder. Yeah.
Yeah.
That you can be so important in a kid's life, even though you don't think maybe you're the one, maybe you are the one.
Right. And you know, that was my experience with youth ministry too. We would look, you know, when I talked, part of the ministry I did was mentoring. We would recruit mentors and we'd talk to these people that a lot of the times with the kids that they're working with, you know, when you and I were growing up, and I think you and I grew up you grew up in Indiana, correct? I grew up in Iowa, mm-hmm. and we had nuclear family. We had a kind of a tighter, in the time we grew up, a tighter knit community probably. There were neighbors that knew me by name. You know, I lived in the same neighborhood as a couple of my teachers. I was in Boy Scouts. I was, you know, so I had this, it was an informal support system. It wasn't, you know, formalized by any stretch of the imagination, but there were people that, you know, knew me. There were adults that knew me, that knew what was going on with my family, that, and if something was going on in the neighborhood, would call my parents, you know, but a lot of kids anymore because of the opioid crisis, just but any kid anymore, it seems like communities are disconnected. So you don't have that support system. And that's why I think it's very important that, especially those of us who are Christ followers, see that we have a great ministry opportunity with children in our neighborhood, with our local schools, that we can, you know, maybe see if, you know, how God can use us to make a difference in the life of a child. And you're about ready to say something.
Oh, I was. Well, I was just going to say, you're right, because, you know, some of the research that I did for the book, and like just since the writing the book, because I'm so interested in it, is just how the class gap has been widening. And so, you know, I read Our Kids by Robert Putnam, which was just so good. And it just talked about how, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, you know, we still had rich people and poor people, but they might still live close together. And so that poor kid that may not have as many opportunities, he still had access to, you know, the business owner down the street that was doing well and, you know, had opportunities and access to mentors, or maybe someone that would write him a recommendation letter to college, or someone that would, you know, he was friends with kids on a soccer team that, you know, were from a different class. But because of those connections, those social connections, you know, there was just more opportunity for kids over across the spectrum in all areas of life. And now, things are being so separated to where people that are richer and people that are poor, they're all kind of segregated into their own communities.
Right.
And so, you know, there's more opportunity for the kids that are, you know, the richer kids, and there's less opportunity for the poor kids, and it continues to grow and grow and grow.
Right.
And, you know, it's like so many people, I feel like, and maybe I don't know the numbers on how many people give money versus how many people actually volunteer, but here's a good example is when I lived in Washington, D.C., I ran with a group called Back on My Feet, mm-hmm. which is a running group that works with recovering addicts and homeless people. And well, they're currently in a homeless rehab center or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I would run with them. I'd run with them for years. I was very heavily involved as a volunteer. And every year there would be this huge fundraiser and all these people would be involved and all these businesses would be involved. And I would go to the meetings about like raising the money. And I would be the only one there that actually went and ran and actually had relationships with these people.
Right.
Everyone else was just donating their money. And I was like, you know, I actually don't give money. I didn't actually give any money to the organization because obviously time is money in some respects.
Right.
But,
right.
But I was like, you're not, I mean, the whole point is that these people need friendships and relationships and you're running with them. And none of you people are doing that. And giving money is great, but like we need people that are willing to like go be with kids and be with people and do the work on the ground and not just write a check. And that's so important. And I mean, that's why I am, I've just had kids, my kids are really tiny. And so I've taken a break from that, but
sure.
I actually was just before you called, sending an email off to Big Brothers and Big Sisters because I am way through the training to become a mentor, and I'm signing up to get matched again. So anyways, point being, like, we need people that are willing to get out there and be with people. And I think that's part of what's missing in some cases.
Great. So you mentioned in your book too that when it comes to small town poverty, rural poverty, that tends to get overlooked. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think there's so many problems, obviously, all the time in the country.
Right.
And it's just hard to know what to focus on. And I think, at least politically speaking, sometimes when like policies or legislation, sometimes it's more popular maybe when you're focused on, I mean, I don't want to cook this to come out the wrong way. But, like, you know, like, sometimes that kind of stuff, when you're focused on, like, a minority group, sometimes I feel like it's more popular. And, you know, some of the poor communities that we're talking about, they're not minority groups, you know, they're more widespread. It's more, you know, not kind of like the trendy thing to talk about, I guess. But I think, you know, I say that all saying that all of these people need to get attention. But sometimes certain groups get overlooked, and sometimes these poor communities in these rural areas are the people that get overlooked, and that's unfortunate.
So, what as far as addressing these issues and these problems, and looking at also the opioid crisis.
It's a hard word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what can, from a public policy standpoint, what can we do to address it? I know Congress just passed a bill related to the opioid crisis. Is that going to actually make a difference, you think? Or what can we do?
That it is going to make a difference. I mean, I think that it's good that Congress is taking it seriously. They're obviously taking it seriously. It was passed almost bipartisan, or it was passed bipartisanly, almost unanimously. There was like 14 people that didn't vote for it, and then it's going to the Senate next, and then you know, they'll conference the bills. But I think it's good that they're taking it so seriously, although I have to say I'm hearing from conservatives a lot of concern about, you know, oh, here we go again, saying government can fix everything. And that is definitely not true. Like, if this is all that's done, if just these bills are passed, then no, this isn't going to solve the problem, because it's only part of the issue.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What do these bills do, I guess, or what does the House bill do in a nutshell?
Yeah. So it has like a bunch of money for education campaigns and prevention campaigns, more money for people that are seeking treatment for rehab and things like that. And then trying to curb kind of like the black market side of the opioid drug trade. And I know there's something else I'm not thinking of. Another thing was, I think one of the big parts, or maybe the whole thing, was about Jesse's Law, which is, you know, making sure that people's medical records are very transparent, so that if someone's getting a prescription for opioids, like, the pharmacists or the doctors are able to see, like, you know, how long have they been being prescribed opioids in.
Right. Or are they shopping around too?
Right. Exactly. Are they going from place to place? So I think that's good, because that is part of it. But the thing is like, how much can we save people from themselves? Because yes, we can try to prevent, you know, over prescription and all of these things. However, like, why are people using the drugs in the first place? Why are people becoming addicted? Mm-hmm. And then if we don't address the issue at heart of it, like why people are doing it, instead of just trying to put chains around the medicine cabinet, then we're never going to really solve the problem, unfortunately. And I think that comes down to, you know, things that are much more deep and less easily painted, you know, written out on a piece of paper. And that comes to issues of the heart and people losing purpose and people being isolated and wanting to numb out problems in their lives. I mean, you see a lot of this is happening in places where there's been a lot of job loss, and people have broken families, or churches are breaking down and people stop going to church. And so that's not a coincidence. And those are the things that we need to address.
Great. So obviously your husband would not have been able to overcome everything from his past in his own flesh. A relationship with Christ has been obviously the thing that has brought him through all of that. What are some as he walks, forward in recovery from, his childhood experiences and recovering from trauma, what are some lessons that God's been teaching him, just even this year as he walks forward
with Jesus? I think that the first thing that comes to mind is just like, is that God is faithful. And I would say that because from the moment that, my husband had planted a seed in his heart, that he should give God a chance, basically. I would say it out loud, cliche to say, but it's true. And from that moment that he just kind of started walking that way, like one shuffle at a time, God has been faithful to his, to him pursuing him. Like he just needed to open his door. My husband just needed to open his heart to the possibility that God could transform him. And as soon as he did that, as soon as he said, okay, I'm going to like try this, it was like, God was like, all right, I'm taking over. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to make some things happen. And that's exactly what happened. And, I think with my husband, like, it's just, to me, my faith has been so strengthened by his, because he didn't expect a miracle to take place, but little by little things begin to change, and he was very faithful in his prayer life. Like he would get up, and he still does, he will pray the same prayer every single day, like, God, heal me from the past, help me to have to get rid of this anxiety. He would just say the same prayers every single day. And like, I feel like many of us don't do that. I feel like many of us pray it once or twice and then we're wondering, why isn't it happening? And I think my husband's journey is really a testament to being consistent and just believing and having that little bit of faith, and just over time watching that actually work and seeing so much healing and transformation take place in his life, and him being unsurprised by it. Like, I'll talk to him about it and I'll be like, so that's really what happened. So you just started praying like every day. And he's like, yep. And he just says it so matter of factly, like he's not emotional about it at all.
Right.
But it's just so, yesterday at church, we got up in front of the church and spoke in front of the church. And I'm telling you, that is not something I believe would have happened 7 years ago. If you told me my husband's going to get in front of the church and talk about how God changed his life, no way. Like, he couldn't even talk in a meeting at work. He couldn't even get his words out because he had such debilitating anxiety about talking to people.
Right.
And yesterday at church, I was like, I feel like you could be a pastor. So, it's a crazy change, and it's amazing to watch. Afterwards, I just started crying. I was like, I cannot believe that you just did that.
Wow.
So,
now that this book's come out, there's probably people that in your circles that, know you kind of, but don't really know the whole story. I mean, are they like, wow, what kind of response are you getting from people that, are in your extended network that?
Yeah. People are pretty shocked at, the kind of things that he has gone through. And, like I said, yesterday at church, we spoke, and so many people came up to us afterwards and had tears in their eyes, when after he explained some of the things that he went through. And so many people have just told even me, I had no idea your husband went through that. Like, I also went through a lot of trauma. Like, people have just been kind of telling us things. So now I'm learning things about people that I didn't know. People that I see on a regular basis that I don't know well. Well, as soon as you open that door, people feel comfortable sharing more with you.
Right.
And then I think that's awesome because it opens up this conversation and it just gives people room to feel like they're not alone.
Right. Well, I appreciate the book. I appreciate the transparency. I mean, that couldn't have been easy to write it in places, I'm sure. It's like, do I really want to put this out there for, anybody just to read? But I think it's definitely needed. And also too, just from your experience from the church, it just makes me, even more confident that, or not confident, that's not the word I'm looking for, more convicted that, we in the church need more of that transparency, right? We need to know, we need to be a safe place for people to share stories like that. And sometimes you know, the church hasn't been that, but I'm glad it has been in your case. Where can people learn more about your book or buy your book? I guess that's not what I want. That's what I wanted to say. Where can they buy it?
Yeah. Well, you can buy it on Amazon if you just type in Leaving Cloud 9, the number 9. We also have a website, leavingcloud9.com. So that has like all the places you can buy it, which is probably 10 or 11. But I think it's even at places like walmart.com. And so you can really get it anywhere. Anywhere books are sold.
Great. Well, hey, I appreciate your time. And God bless you. And praise God for this amazing story. It was so inspiring to read through that and just to see what God has done in his life and how he's brought him through that. Because, like I said, that, you know, humanly speaking, this wouldn't have been possible with all the stuff that he's had going on. But, you know, it's just encouraging to see how God has walked with him through that and is working with him through that. So appreciate
it. Yeah, that's why we wanted to tell the story, just to show how, you know, people don't have to be hopeless, even no matter how hard of a, you know, past that they've had. So.
All right. Well, hey, take care, Erica. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please make sure that you go check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. That's CAFFEINATED, caffeinatedthoughts.com, or Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and we will show up at the top of your search screen. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our emails so you don't miss a single article. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Please be sure to give us 5 stars. Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. If you're not a subscriber, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and you can listen using your favorite podcast app. Until next time, my friends, this is Shane Vanderhart. Take care.